Welcome to the Business of Health podcast. This is a podcast that highlights issues that could cost group health agents and brokers thousands of dollars. The health insurance industry is constantly changing, and each episode, we're going to give you tools to grow a profitable business and better serve your clients. I'm your host, Mike Martins. Now, let's grow your health business. Well, I hope everybody is having a great week, and thank you again for tuning in to our 16th episode of Business of Health. We have a tremendous show today, and I want to take just a second and comment on my First Staff Benefits staff and the content and the guests that they have worked to bring to the show, because our audience is growing exponentially. We're bringing on more and more business owners, HR professionals, and group health brokers and agents. So I think we're hitting the mark with our content, and we appreciate the feedback. And the content that we're going to talk about today, I think, is critically important, because whether you're a business owner, HR professional, or a group insurance producer, at some point in your career, you're going to hit a merger and acquisition situation. It might be with your company, or it might be a scenario where you're getting deep in the weeds with a prospect and you get that call that none of us like to get, and you're told, hey, we got to put everything on hold. It looks like we're going to acquire someone, or we're going to sell to someone. And we've got a great guest to address this today. And for those of you that are, and I keep calling it NAHU, I've got to get over to this NABIP mentality, but for those of you that are NAHU members and get the America's Benefit Specialist magazine, in the March issue, there's a tremendous article in there that was authored by our guest. And as with any publication, it's brief in content. I think that we want to kind of go a little bit deeper into the weeds today on some of these topics that are going to help you when you're faced with this situation of at least kind of being ahead of the curve as it pertains to health and welfare benefit plans. My guest today is Stacy Barrow, and he's a partner with Barrow Weatherhead Lent, which is a boutique employee benefits and executive compensation and employment law firm in the beautiful city of Boston, Massachusetts. Now, Stacy's been licensed to practice law for over 20 years and has been in private practice for over 15. He has an extensive technical knowledge and experience in the design and implementation of health and welfare plans so they can meet all of the requirements of state and federal law. Now, before co-founding his firm in 2015, Stacy did serve as an in-house counsel to a prominent employee benefits and group health insurance brokerage consulting firm. So he's kind of been on our side of the fence, so to speak, as well as on the legal side of the fence. Stacy, welcome to the Business of Health.
Hi, Mike. Good to be here.
Awesome to have you. And we've got a lot of ground to cover today, so I kind of want to jump right in. We talked about the article in the March issue of a benefit specialist, and there's a ton of information there, but I want to dive a little bit deeper into those topics that you discussed in the magazine. And one of the things that I noted in your article that you didn't have a lot of time or a lot of room, I guess I should say, to talk about what can occur in the event in a merger or acquisition, we end up with a control group. And those can bring some interesting twists and turns to the table. Tell me a little bit more about what could take two groups coming together and create that environment, and what the business owner or the consultant needs to kind of be aware of and pay attention to.
Sure. So yeah, after a merger or acquisition, you probably will end up with a control group in one form or another, usually with the purchasing entity and the target company. There are various types of control groups. They exist at different levels of common ownership, and they basically require companies to be treated as a single unit for certain purposes of federal tax law and ERISA. They allow an entity treated as a single employer for ERISA purposes can offer a single employer group health plan, which is pretty useful. But companies that are not part of the same control group generally can participate in the same single employer group health plan. But you certainly may have companies that'll be a control group post-acquisition. It typically, when one company purchases all the stock of another, or at least 80%, say, then they'll have a parent subsidiary controlled group. You can also have other types of controlled groups called brother-sister controlled groups. They also generally require at least 80% common ownership between five or fewer of the same individuals, trusts, or estates. But these issues are incredibly nuanced. You can have controlled groups that exist at lower levels of common ownership. You can have what are called affiliated service groups or management organizations. Either of them can exist at an ownership of less than 80% in common, get down to 25% or even 0% in some cases.
So, Stacy, we obviously have been talking about control groups. One of the things that can occur, and we don't want it to occur, is for there to unintentionally for something to become a MEWA or a multiple employer welfare association. So let's talk about that a little bit. What are some of those pitfalls and hazards?
Yeah, you're right that sometimes after a transaction, a group health plan might inadvertently become a MEWA. It'll cover employees of two or more unrelated employers who, you know, companies that don't share sufficient common ownership to be considered a controlled group. Yeah, this can be, you know, a major issue, a major concern if the arrangement is self-insured. If it is fully insured, it's less of an issue from a regulatory perspective. So, you know, we often see fully insured MEWAs that are created for a brief period of time after a corporate transaction. There are even rules in the federal M1 form filing instructions that allow a plan that would otherwise have an M1 filing obligation, but for a corporate transaction, to avoid filing that form for a period of time following the deal. If the arrangement is self-insured, there's a much greater concern there due to the level of state regulation. You obviously have to talk with your own counsel at that point, but, you know, 30 days or so to bridge a gap here or there, you might get comfortable with, but, you know, you don't want an inadvertent self-insured MEWA to go on and on after a transaction.
And I can see how that can happen, because the reality is there are a lot of ALEs out there that are self-insured. And the larger the group, the higher that probability. And if I'm kind of following your line of thought here, if it does happen, as long as it is addressed and dealt with in a reasonably immediate fashion, I don't want to say it's a no harm, no foul, but it's not catastrophic, correct?
Yeah, I mean, these arrangements are regulated very strictly at the state and federal level because of some unscrupulous promoters in years past. The rules, you know, the enforcement generally isn't geared toward these inadvertent MEWAs that are formed after a deal temporarily. So while they are implicated by these rules, there are many practitioners in practice that will feel comfortable with a very temporary MEWA because it's often done in the best interest of participants. The insurance, the gap in coverage or disruption in coverage. So, you know, the thought is there's a pretty good argument as to why we're doing it.
Okay. Let's talk for a minute about my favorite topic, and that's the Affordable Care Act. As you know, Stacy, First Staff Benefits works with hundreds of clients across the country in the design and implementation of benefit programs to enable those employers to avoid at least benefit-based penalties. And we certainly work with some qualified strategic partners to assist on the reporting side. But let's talk about, and we're going to assume obviously for a minute that these entities that are joining are both ALEs. What needs to be the due diligence when it comes to whether or not the company that is being acquired has met what they should meet under the ACA rules and regs?
Sure. As part of the due diligence process, one of the many pieces of information that buyer will seek from seller, so when seller's an ALE, are copies of its ACA reporting forms going back any number of years. You know, frankly, the more the better from buyer's perspective. You know, they would probably look at all of them, you know, if they could. It's been going on since the 2015, 2016, the very least the last 3 years, just to demonstrate that the reporting has been performed. And of course, all of the backup information with that, you know, the plan documents, and we can make sure that they were offering coverage to all full-time employees, at least through the plan documents. So copies of those forms, the very least. Sometimes you can't always get copies. And, you know, you need to get representations from seller that they were filed, you know, some understanding as to why you can't get copies, you know, were they filed electronically, were they filed on paper, and what's the story there? Did they ever receive any IRS letters? The ACA reporting is, you know, one of the biggest considerations on the health and welfare side in transactions.
Well, you know, one of the items that we always advise our clients, because companies typically will make changes to payroll vendors frequently. And if you have made a change to a payroll vendor, or you're going to make a change to a payroll vendor, make darn sure that you have got access to all of that information from that current provider. So down the road, if you need to pull payroll data from 2018, because Stacy, you and I know this, I hope everybody else does, there's no statute of limitations on this ACA reporting situation. So if for some reason they want to look at 2018 or 2019 and 2023, they can do it. So we've always advised, make sure you always have access to your old payroll data in the event that you're getting ready to make a change. The second piece of this really comes into the type of platform that a client is offering. The vast majority of ALEs out there are offering minimum essential coverage, and the number that are offering minimum value plans is dwindling because that market is becoming more and more difficult to tap into. So let's kind of take an example here and work through it, that ABC is getting ready to acquire XYZ. They're both ALEs, and XYZ has only been offering MEC to their employees, which has left the window open for potential penalties under 4980HB. How would that be addressed? Because, you know, the Internal Revenue is just now doing 2019. So here we're recording this session in the spring of 2023. It's pretty easy to assume that there's going to be a two-year gap before you get any notifications from IRS concerning plan year 2023. What thoughts or ideas do you have on how that would be addressed if in this merger acquisition situation, it's discovered that the company being acquired has only been offering MEC?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I guess if we do discover that, you'd want to bake something in the transaction document to account for that. At some point, you get the penalty letter, the 226J letter from the IRS, that it'll come out of some basket established by the seller, essentially, to, you know, account for these liabilities. I mean, I don't know that you said fewer employers are offering minimum value coverage. I mean, minimum value is just a major medical plan. It's a real bare bones arrangement. Yep. It's simply preventive care. So, I mean, I think fewer employers are offering MECs and maybe moving to an ICHRA in a situation where they would have offered a MEC previously. I mean, MECs are really specialized and used only in a certain circumstance, but most of the time, we find that ALEs offer minimum value coverage. There may be some issues with affordability, but either way, right, if there's an affordability issue or a minimum value issue where they're only offering MEC, you would need to account for that.
Well, and we have seen a huge migration to ICHRA because for a lot of employers, particularly ALEs that have large number of lower wage episodic employment, might be temp staffing, might be hospitality, ICHRA is an easy way for them to manage both sides to that equation. And it is growing exponentially also, Stacy. I mean, it's incredible the number of inquiries and movement that we have to people wanting to go that direction. Okay, we've beat up the ACA. So let's take a second and talk about considerations in this merger acquisition world when it comes to employees that are on COBRA. And let's say that you've got two health plans that are becoming one. What type of things do we kind of need to be looking out for and watching out for as it pertains to COBRA?
Sure. You're usually not really merging two plans, so to speak. You know, you probably have seller either terminating all its plans in connection with the sale, or possibly maintaining a plan in connection with the sale or someone in seller's control group. The general rule with regard to COBRA in acquisitions is that the liability or the obligation for the M&A qualified beneficiaries remains with seller as long as seller or seller's group, someone within seller's control group, continues to offer a group health plan. If they don't, the obligation shifts to the buyer. And then the parties can also negotiate for the obligations as well in their concept of the springing COBRA obligation. You know, it's always very important to deal that the parties talk with benefits counsel and, you know, understand who they're taking. Because a lot of times, you know, the buyer may not want to take M&A qualified beneficiaries. And they say, well, you know, they've never been on our plan. You know, what do you mean? But if seller's terminating all of its plans, it's very likely the buyer is going to have the obligation for the COBRA qualified beneficiaries.
And obviously that's understood. And it's one of those things that could kind of, I would think, could potentially roll off the table until you're deep into negotiations, because now all of a sudden we've discovered that the seller is picking up, and I'll grab a number, 25 or 30 COBRA people that is risk they've never carried before. Because typically when you get into an M&A situation, you have like types of industries coming together. People are expanding, they're growing, and they're doing it through acquisition. And so you have similar types of populations, but that's an excellent point because you got to manage and take care of those COBRA people. The other item that I wanted to touch on, because it's something that is very popular, we see a lot of companies doing it, is flexible spending accounts. And HSAs are a little bit different because although they're certainly out there and there's a large number of employers that are offering HSAs, we don't see a lot of employer-based contribution on that side. And that HSA is an account that really belongs to the employee. FSA, not so much. So let's talk about the considerations of looking at, for the seller and the buyer, looking at a flex spending account, and how does that have to be managed?
Sure. You know, there are a few issues that we run into with the FSA accounts. A lot of times if we're representing buyer or advising buyer may want to terminate seller's plans, or they're going to bring seller's employees over and treat them as their own, and they'll make new elections under buyer's plan. And so they may feel like they need to terminate the FSA mid-year. But if it's a stock deal, they don't necessarily have to terminate it, or they could let it run out so that employees aren't disrupted. There's also ways to transfer the balances from sellers to buyers FSA. If both of them have an FSA and they're on the same plan year, there's an old revenue ruling that describes this, and it works either in asset or in stock deals. But buyer could or seller could terminate the FSA. That may be disruptive to employees, but they can, you know, generally make a new election under buyer's FSA. Some of the rules are a little nuanced. It really depends on the facts and circumstances. The seller needs to think about if they're terminating their FSA early, they're running a short plan year essentially, and the annual contribution is prorated for short plan years,
right?
Might not account when they start as a plan year. So there's all kinds of little things to think through with the FSAs.
Okay. What is important, Stacy, that we haven't touched on yet? Or are there things or items that on the HR or the broker agent side, when they're brought into this mix, that they need to be cognizant of or they need to kind of keep an eye on?
Well, you're right that you mentioned earlier that benefits are often thought of late in the game in the transaction context. You know, just getting access to the benefits folks to the data room early on so we can take a look at the important items like the 5500s and AC reporting. And for retirement plans, we need to understand their loans, and, you know, there's like, you know, different issues with retirement plans. So letting it go to the end, that doesn't help anyone. Reduces the amount of information really that the parties can consider. They have to consider it in a rush. It gives less time to maybe consider some of the context and facts as to, you know, why information is lacking or looks the way that it does.
It's, I guess, Stacy, it's kind of like everything. You want to get everything up on the table. as quickly as you possibly can. Because from the HR and benefit perspective, the producer that jumps into this feet first and is helpful and can provide data and can bring ideas to the table, you know, have you thought about the FSA concept? Have you thought about the COBRA issue? You thought about the ACA situations? You're going to be in a better position to retain and maintain that role as a trusted advisor to that company. And so don't go, oh no, and stick your head in the sand when you get that phone call or that email saying, oh, hey, Mike, I forgot to tell you, we're selling. Because we went through this not 2 weeks ago. And unfortunately, and it worked out fine, but unfortunately, our notification came when I received an email from the VP of HR that had a new logo on it. And I'm kind of like, oh, okay. So, you know, we didn't have that opportunity because we were totally unaware of what was transpiring. So get in there, ask questions, be involved, be supportive, and that's best way to go. Well, unfortunately, we have got to wrap up. So, Stacy, I really, really appreciate your insight. I think being open and being a good communicator in these processes is absolutely imperative to your success. And if questions come up after the session, how does somebody reach you, Stacy?
They can go to our website, marbarlaw.com. You can Google my name, Stacy Barrow, and it should come up with a link right to our website, and you can contact me through there.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for being on this episode of Business of Health, Stacy. We really appreciate your insight and your knowledge.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, the only bad news today is that we're at the end of the show. So thanks for listening to the Business of Health podcast. Listening to this show puts your agency in position for success. Remember to click the link below, check out my website at www.firststaffbenefits.com. Give me a shout. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Keep listening, keep learning, and keep taking action. Until next time, this is Mike Martins, signing off.